those for maybe an hour or a little longer. We're going to go ahead and start on SB 894, open a public hearing. Mike Becker. I'm going to bring you all up. There's only three of them signed up. Kevin, is it Earls? And Lori Long. Please state your name for the record, and you can start in any order you want.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lori Long with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Senate Bill 894A comes to you from the Prompt Payment Work Group facilitated by the department. We met with Senator Fisher in the Senate side back in January with representatives from the Oregon Medical Association and the health insurance community to discuss growing concerns surrounding timeliness of payment from insurers to healthcare providers. At that time, Senator Fisher requested that the department facilitate a work group of healthcare providers and insurers to develop a bill to address these concerns. And with me today are members of that work group to speak in detail of the bill.
Vice Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Mike Becker with the Regents Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Oregon Health Plan. I'm here today to speak in favor of SB 894. I first want to express appreciation on behalf of Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon and the other providers of health insurance to the department and to the providers, the physicians and hospital community in this state who worked so hard to come up with this compromise measure. We think this is meaningful change in regard to prompt payment of medical bills. And on behalf of the carriers and Regents, again, we wish to state our belief that prompt payment of medical bills is something that is desirable and something that this bill brings about meaningful change in that area. This is a compromise on some very difficult issues. It guards against the desire to overregulate and micromanage insurers in the payment of claims, but it does so in a meaningful way, again, that results in meaningful change in this area of law. The bill does have a number of mandates, and Kevin Earls will mandates and provisions that bring about this change. Kevin Earls will talk about the specifics of those. There is a significant incentive in this bill for prompt payment of medical bills, and there is a significant enforcement mechanism, not only through interest, but also through the market conduct remedy and review with the department. There will be increased administrative costs associated with this bill, but based on the balanced approach that is taken in this measure, we think that's manageable by the industry. The bill will also result in the gathering of meaningful data, which is a change from where we are right now. There was significant disagreement between the carriers and the providers and the department over where are we currently with the prompt payment of medical bills. This bill requires carriers to report. It also requires the department to come back in the, I believe it's the 73rd legislative session, and report to this assembly on how successful we have been with these reforms. Just in general, the bill does define clean claim. It sets forth time frames for payment. There is notification to providers when claims are pended. As I mentioned before, there's interest on late payment of claims and reporting requirements. All of this, again, is meaningful change. We support the bill, and we urge the committee's passage of it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Shetterly.
Well, just the bill, it doesn't define clean claim. It directs the department to define clean claim with, I guess, reference to Medicaid. What is the Medicaid definition, just in simplest terms, you know, of a clean claim? How hard is it to constitute a clean claim on the first try?
Well, basically, and I could quote it for you specifically, but basically what the Medicare definition does, if that is ultimately what the department looks to, and the bill does encourage the department to look to that definition, it basically is a claim that doesn't require any additional information from another source for its payment. Now, that could be internal by way of terms of the policy. If the premiums have not been paid on the policy, obviously the claim is not clean, not by the provider's fault, but by the insured's fault. Or if it is external information in regard to other information that is necessary for payment of that claim, that information would be gathered before the claim would be clean.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kevin Earls, Vice President of Finance and Health Policy for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And I'll just make a couple of brief additions to by way of introduction, and then walk quickly through key provisions of the bill, if you like. Oregon is one of only six states without legislation establishing policy guidance in the area of prompt payment of medical claims. And this measure is really our collective attempt to try and address that gap in Oregon's policy. We do have current law, but it really is focused on the concept of prompt acknowledgement of receipt of a claim. It doesn't really deal with the prompt payment of a claim. The Oregon Medical Association introduced Senate Bill 894 to address the issue following a survey of their members' concerns and experiences, which occurred in late part of last calendar year. The insurers responded with a bill of their own addressing the issue, and the parties came together and worked on resolving the differences. Looking to the key provisions of the bill, directed to Section 2, Sub 1, insurers must pay, deny, or request more information within 30 days of receipt of a clean claim. And receipt means the carrier has taken possession of the claim. We had quite a bit of discussion about that, but ultimately decided that the plain meaning of receipt was that the claim had come into the possession of the carrier. We also had substantial discussion about the request for additional information and that it must be comprehensive. In current practices, it's not uncommon for a carrier to have to ask for subsequent information. This really clarifies that the carrier has one bite at the apple when requesting additional information. They need to be comprehensive in their request. Also, in sub one, it makes it clear that the insurer must pay or deny the claim within 30 days of the receipt of the additional information that's requested. In sub two, it clarifies that the contract between the insurer and provider cannot abridge the payment rights of a provider as established in the bill, and that is the background on that is that it was important, I think, to providers that they not end up, after the passage of this bill, receiving or being offered a contract which, in essence, provided different terms than is put forward in this legislation. In sub 3, the insurer shall establish a method for communicating procedures and information for completing claims and making it available to providers. We talked about reasonably available and most current information, and DCBS, who is an important partner in the development of this legislation, has asserted that it has the authority to interpret on these issues. So what we were really trying to get at was to make sure that providers have access to the current practices and requirements that a carrier has for submitting a clean claim, so that we know what the bullseye is as providers. In sub 4, we clarified that this bill does not create an assignment of payment where one does not exist or is not permitted. And that is to address a concern that that carriers had, that if they have a non-participating provider, someone that they're not under, that's not on their participating panel, that they're not obligated to directly pay that provider for a claim under this bill if they don't already make arrangements to do so. In sub 5, The bill states insurers must report annually to DCBS on their success in complying with this new law according to the requirements that the director will establish. So we originally in the development of legislation talked about having DCBS provide a more active role in monitoring the success of the legislation and the carriers' compliance with the legislation. And that was an area where DCBS felt that they didn't have the manpower to play too active of a role. And so we created a self-reporting concept where carriers are required to report to DCBS on how they're doing. In sub six, the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services will adopt a definition of clean claim and will consider the federal Medicare definition when doing so. The definition will be created through rulemaking process. This is an area where both parties, I think, felt, or all parties felt, that they wanted to conform to the Medicare definition. So there was no debate or argument about that. It's really trying to standardize on what the definition of clean claim is.
Chair?
Yes.
Well, I'm just curious, Kevin, on that. Why did the work group ultimately punt to DCBS, and why not just define clean claim in the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, original drafting of the language did put into the bill a definition of clean claim. Legislative Council advised us that we had a delegation problem with referencing the Medicare definition.
Yeah.
So this was our approach to getting around that. It's our intention to develop a rule that defines a clean claim under the Medicare standard, but it was our advice that it was a delegation problem.
Well, thanks. I didn't mean just dividing it by reference. I mean, you could have just stated the definition in equivalent terms to the Medicaid definition without referencing or without delegating. I'm just curious, is there some area that we anticipate this may not be on all fours with the Medicaid definition?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, no. If by chance the federal government revises the definition of clean claim under Medicare, we would then have to come back and seek a statute change. This gives us the flexibility to remain consistent with federal government under department rule, and that was agreeable to all the parties on the work.
It just seems odd to me that we're creating a statute that requires the department to consider a definition. I don't know if anyone else
on. I think
it just seems like an odd way to do this. And, is that any comment on that?
Vice Chair Krieger, Representative Sederle, and Representative Ringo, if I might add something to that. One of the things that we know is coming down the pike from the federal government is some changes through the HIPAA statute. And as we move into more and more of the electronic realm of claim submission and claim payment, there will be changes in this definition over the next 5 years. I think we can anticipate that. We tried to draft this in the broadest sense to give us flexibility, give the department flexibility to have a definition that is consistent with federal law now and evolves with federal law as we move into those changes in the future, rather than defining it right now and having this assembly come back and have to fiddle with it time after time. So that flexibility was one of the considerations that went into drafting and taking the approach that we have.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ringo, one of the basic compromises from the work group was that we were all in agreement that the standard for clean claim should be the Medicare standard. It's consistent in the industry. It doesn't bifurcate the system, create two standards for clean claim that insurers will have to be held to. And this language was crafted in order to accomplish that, anticipating changes in the federal rules.
Yes. Question for anyone on the panel, I guess. Is there information now as to what the, is there an average length of time for payment of a claim And what, among all providers and among the industry, what is that average? And will this bring it down? I mean, I'm sure it's more, I know it's more than 30 days, and I'll bet it's more than 60 days, which seems to be what you're getting at here. What is it now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cheverly, this is an area where there was broad disagreement about the facts. And I think if we all have one hope as a result of the adoption of this legislation, is that it will create a reporting mechanism and a record-keeping process that eliminates disputes over what is the truth around that issue in the future. The Oregon Medical Association conducted a survey that I referenced earlier that showed claims payments taking quite some time, and I don't have the numbers with me, but the industry responded with a very different fact set. And rather than get embroiled in what the truth was, since no one could really agree, we created, I think, a provision in the bill that, helps all parties agree in the future.
Mr. Chair. Well, I guess I'll be encouraged. I wish this were stronger. Serving as chair of the board of the community hospital in Dallas, I've seen the aging reports, and it's months and months in a lot of cases. And that's after two or three responses back for more information and more information given and requests for, as you said, kind of this piecemeal approach to getting information to ultimately pay the claim. So if we can get this down even to 60 days, which I still think is too long, well, at least we'll have moved the ball in the right direction. I'll be interested to see how this goes, because I'm going to bet that it's months and months, whatever that is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cheverly, one of the main purposes of the reporting requirements in this bill is for the department to be able to collect data that will give us a clearer picture. So our hope is when we come back to you during the 73rd Legislative Assembly, we'll be able to give you a clear picture of where we're at and where we've come from today.
Okay. Any further questions?
One.
Representative Becky Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I missed most of the discussion, I'm sorry. But one thing I did want to ask is there any provision in here or any effort to clean this process up when people are double insured? That actually seems to take more time. I just wrote a note to Representative Cheverly. I just had a claim that was 4 months old that finally got paid. Because there just seems to be some long period of delay between the two insurance carriers, even though I think they're represented by the same parent company.
Representative Walker.
That's who I am.
Chair Krieger, that was not an issue that was discussed during the prompt payment work group. Might ask Mr. Becker to step in on this question, but no, it was not something that we discussed.
Vice Chair Krieger and Representative Walker, the issue you're referring to is coordination of benefits among two different carriers. That is one of the things that actually goes into the determination of when you have a clean claim, because when you have that situation, there is yet a whole different set of rules administered by the department in regard to how you administer those claims where there are two carriers. And It is a problem area, because it has to be sorted out as to which carrier is primary, which is secondary, and then the payment made based on that.
Yeah, and if I might, the additional problem is that they go by the birth date of the policyholder. So in my situation, my children come under my insurance first, and then under my husband's second. So it's very confusing most of the time, and it takes a long period of time to get those bills paid, and I get collection notices, which I don't appreciate, and I'd like to see my providers get paid on a more timely basis.
Vice Chair Krieger, Representative Walker, it is a very complicated area. One thing that this bill will do that will help with the process is whenever the insurer communicates with the insured regarding coordination of benefits, for example, they will also be required to send the same information, copy it to the provider. So the provider and the insured will be kept informed of what's going on, what information is being gathered and requested. So that should help in the communication process and the speeding up of the payment of these claims and the gathering of that information for coordination of benefits.
That's what I want to hear. Thank you.
Any further questions? I might have one for Mr. Becker. Some of the legislators, family members work in their offices, so they might be double insured. For instance, my wife, well, she's also insured underneath my own policies. There's two Blue Cross policies that cover her. Then we have a separate policy of our own for certain other type of coverages. So we're dealing with three. Can you address how that's handled?
Vice Chair Krieger and members of the committee, that issue, again, has to do with the coordination of benefits and determination of which policy is primary and secondary. Now, there are certain types of policies that are not coordinated with at all. You mentioned yet a third type of coverage where it might be some sort of supplemental coverage for certain types of care or treatment. Typically, those types of policies that are different from comprehensive health insurance policies are not coordinated with. But it is a complicated area, and I would have to address a specific determination of how would it pay in a given case. If I had specific facts, I could work with our claims people and give you a specific answer as to, in a given case, how it would pay.
Okay, thank you. Any further comments? Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify regarding SB 894? Okay, I'll close a public hearing on SB 894 and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 894A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Walker moves SB 894 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections?
That's Representative Cheryl Walker.
Cheryl Walker, any comments? We're okay till you get here.
I know.
Want to call the roll, please?
Representative
Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Ackman?
Aye.
Representative Dean Felder? Aye. Representative Dingell? Aye. Representative Walker? Aye. Representative Cheryl Walker? Aye. Representative Vincent Walker? Aye. Representative Buckman? Aye. Vice Chair Lowe? He's excused. He's excused. Okay, SB 894 does move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Who would like to be the carrier?
I'm the carrier.
Okay. Representative Cheryl Walker. I'll carry the bill.
Is that the first bill of Thomas, you mean?
But we have a minute coming by 398. Oh, wow.
Oh, okay, we just got it. We can do that one if you want. We just got them.
We're going to open a work session on House Bill 3908, and we've just received the dash 8s.
That's right, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. In front of you, you have House Bill 3908-8. Those come from the proponents. And I'd ask Randy, if it's all right, Mr. Chair, I'd ask Randy Tucker to come up and explain the goals of the dash 8s.
Thank you, Vice Chair Krieger, members of the committee, and with me is Robert Liberty. Oh, my name is Randy Tucker, for the record, 1,000 Friends of Oregon. With me is Robert Liberty, Executive Director of 1,000 Friends of Oregon. In the work session last week, or the almost work session last week, a couple of questions arose regarding House Bill 3908, and I believe we've addressed all of those questions in the amendments you have before you, the dash 8. As you'll recall, there were parties that objected to the mandatory remand element of the bill, and we have inserted language that similar to what I distributed to you last week as conceptual amendments If you look at page 3 of the amendment, the very last paragraph starting on line 18, we have added a provision that allows LUBA to uphold a local land use decision even if it violates the provisions of this bill, which require recusal or reporting of potential conflicts of interest. If LUBA finds through an evidentiary hearing or review of a transcript of the proceedings that the violation did not affect the outcome of the decision. And I believe this substantially addresses the concerns of that Harlan Levy presented to the subcommittee last week. We have also eliminated expedited land divisions from the bill because Legislative Council taught this. Expedited land divisions do not go to LUBA. They go to the Court of Appeals. It wasn't the most important part of the bill. We just dropped them out. Representative Shetterly raised in the discussion last week some possible conflicts with Chapter 244, the conflict of interest provisions in that chapter. And so we have added, if you look at page 1 of the amendments, line 15 and 16, and lines 23 and 24, we've added some language to ensure that if there's a conflict, the Chapter 244 rules in those cases. And other than that, it's just a couple of word changes to clean things up. And I got a phone call this morning from John Chandler, representing the home builders, who was just leaving Portland and said he wouldn't be here in time, but he asked me to convey to the committee that the amendments, all the totality of the amendments that this bill has undergone over the last few weeks address his concerns with the bill, and he is okay with the bill. So,
Mr. Chair? Well, I just want to say thank Randy and Robert Liberty for their work on this. I think their amendments, as reflected in the 8th as I'm reading them, do seem to address the two principal issues that I had. Well, that was one, as Randy said, the manner in which this bill differed with Chapter 244, which is the conflict of interest statute that generally applies to all elected officials. And my concern was that this bill suggested that a member of a planning commission could do something in compliance with this bill that would in fact put them in violation of the conflict of interest statutes under Chapter 244. And that's been addressed in lines 15 through 21. And also the concern I had about the automatic, non-discretionary, absolutely must remand standard that was initially in the bill. I think they've accommodated that with the language on page 3 that really gives LUBA the discretion to look and make sure that there are cases where they can look and call no harm, no foul. That still might leave a person in violation of Chapter 244 if they violated that, but in terms of the outcome of the decision, it's not going to require a remand. Were to do that, would only be to delay an inevitable result if it didn't have any effect on the decision. So I'm satisfied with the amendments, and given that this is a House bill and we're late in getting House bills out, my inclination, Mr. Chair, if you're willing to receive, would be make a motion.
Certainly.
Okay, then I would move the dash 8s into House Bill 3908.
Any discussion? Objections? Not the dash 8s are moved into the bill, Mr. Chair.
I know that Mr. Kapoor didn't get an opportunity to speak to the bill.
Would you like to come up and talk to the bill a minute?
Well, he's coming. Let me just ask, do the dash 8s incorporate all the previous?
All the previous amendments, that's correct. And for those members of the full committee that are not on the subcommittee, Mr. Chair, the earlier version of the bill included campaign contributions as one of the possible triggers for a conflict, and we've deleted that. We've made many other amendments before we ever had a hearing on this bill. So, and yes, the one other thing to mention is that the other major amendment to the bill that differs from the bill as printed, as introduced, is that LCDC has been added to its provisions, as well as Metro, by the way, which was not in the original language either. So the bill now covers all local governments and LCDC.
Steve, do you have something you want to speak to?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Cafori. I appreciate the courtesy of the chair and the committee. I will not read this whole letter, even though it is short. I've been asked by Mike Houck, Urban Naturalist of the Audubon Society of Portland, to present this testimony for the record. Briefly, he states that the bill would establish ethical standards for officials making land use decisions. And he's particularly concerned about conflict of interest that affect land use decisions where fish and wildlife habitat protection are concerned. In my 20 years of work on Oregon's land use goal 5, I've witnessed case after case where a sitting committee member, whether it be LCDC or a local planning commission, has clearly had a conflict of interest. We have specific concerns with LCDC commissioners who one day represent development interests at the local or regional level, and next day render decisions regarding the implementation of land use regulations. These decisions have had very real consequences at the local and regional levels of government, and we support adoption 3998.
Steve, I assume you approve of the dash 8.
We're delighted with the dash 8, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
sir. I move House Bill 3908 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Shetterly has moved 3908 to the floor with a due pass. Are there any comments? Any objections?
Aye.
Representative Ackerman?
I just have a question and perhaps a concern as to how this is supposed to work. As I read it, if the official makes a disclosure, then that official also makes a determination as to whether he or she has an actual potential conflict of interest. Does that preclude the rest of the board from asking that person questions regarding the actual potential conflict of interest? Or is this just something that somebody declares and then the person says, well, I can still act fairly and impartially and they proceedings continue? I'm just sort of a process question, and I'm curious
about. Mr. Liberty, can you answer that?
Yes, Mr. Vice Chair and Representative Ackerman. Nothing precludes that kind of questions. Okay. I'm sorry, Robert Liberty, 1000 Friends. Nothing precludes that kind of discussion among members of the board or planning commission or metro council. Ultimately, of course, will be a decision made by that elected official or appointed official about whether she or he is capable of rendering the kind of decision under the standard adopted by the bill. But what's different here, and certainly different than the existing standards established by the Supreme Court in the Rajneesh case, is that there is an opportunity for review by another tribunal, Land Use Board of Appeals, to determine whether or not that standard was met. So there's a reasonable person standard. So it's not just purely the discretion of the individual. There will be, and over time, we'll have more of a clear understanding of when non-participation is required.
Thank you.
Okay, any further comments? Can you call the roll, please?
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Backman?
Aye.
Representative
Jim
Felder?
Aye.
Representative Grindel?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Representative Cheryl Walker?
Aye.
Representative Walker?
Aye.
Representative
Wilson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cleaver?
Aye.
Okay, House Bill 3908 moves to the floor with a due pass. He's already left. I was just going to ask him about who was going to carry the bill.
Thank you.
You there? Mr. Liberty, do you know if, would you like to have either Representative Lee or Representative Haas carry the bill on the floor? They're familiar with it. Why don't we have them as co-carriers on the bill? Haas and Lee, Representative Haas and Lee, and make sure they're notified. Okay, we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 704.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 704, as the members of the Civil Subcommittee will recall, comes from Senator Shields, and it requires that a clergy person who solemnizes a marriage identify on the marriage certificate the religious congregation or organization that authorized that person to perform marriage ceremonies. And what it, the main purpose of the bill is that it deletes the requirement that the clergy person file an affidavit of authority to perform marriages in each specific case, because they were finding that it was really complicated, and there was a lot of difficulty as to who was in charge of making sure that the affidavit was properly filed in each marriage ceremony. No amendments, and because we didn't move it through the subcommittee, we don't have a carrier on this, Mr. Chair.
It didn't go before the civil?
It did, but we've collapsed it before we actually ever passed it out of there.
Okay, is there anyone that wants to testify? I don't think there is. Committee members, do you have any comments or objections to the...
Well, I will make one note, and that is that I am aware that there are some programs available on the internet, classes or opportunities to join a congregation and become certified as clergy. Various new churches and so forth are springing up that give people the authority to wed others. I don't know if this is going to add to the proliferation of that as a proselytizing device to get people to join a religion, or if this is going to limit that. But I just would make the comment that it would be of good use to have somewhere in the clergy person's file some source of information that speaks to his authority and qualifications for performing the services that they perform for the public.
Is there anyone on the civil that was any of that type of thing brought up in her question?
She's on the civil subcommittee, but that specific issue was not brought up in regards to the authorization from some of the internet types of training. But Senator Shields, I think, was here. If you
Senator
wish to
Shields?
Comment to that, but
maybe you can answer the question or concern.
I did not bring that up during the civil sub because I just now became aware of it over the weekend. Somebody pointed out to me several individuals who are now performing wedding ceremonies in our community who received their ordination over the net.
This question hasn't arisen in my presence before, but I just stopped in to answer any questions that you might have, and let me give you my take on it. The bill came to me from the judicatories of denominations because the system it used to exist was that county clerks had to authorize who was qualified to do a marriage and who wasn't. County clerks didn't want the job. They didn't feel qualified to do the job. So in 99, we moved it over to denominations and had church denominations authorize who was qualified to marry people and who wasn't. But the denominations, the state headquarters, don't have the kind of staff and resources to do it either. And it particularly, this bill was designed particularly for one thing. If, for instance, a Catholic priest in Massachusetts comes to Oregon just to do a wedding for a friend, right now the Catholic Church would have to call back to Massachusetts, authenticate his qualifications, and then out here at this end would have to get an affidavit, go to a notary of the public. It's just all kinds of hassle. The county clerks and clergy representatives met, and they agreed that the simplest way to do it was just to add a couple lines to the marriage certificate. That's why the delay in implementation. It gives the county clerks a chance to add to the certificate. And that addition to the certificate can, there were some examples, but each county can develop its own, and they could answer this question probably with that kind of a development. It simply says you have to state, you know, the judicatory or the congregation that authorizes you to do marriages. in a real sense, nothing changes because the counties have never been in charge of determining who does a marriage. It's always been up to the church. So if you come up with a new internet church that people accept as a church, I guess, you know, they would qualify. Who would go to them? I don't know.
It really
you
doesn't
know.
Change anything, does
huh?
it?
It doesn't change the status. It yeah. makes it a lot simpler administratively to have the clergy person, and I've done hundreds of marriages, just sign at the bottom, you know, that I'm recognized, for instance, in my case, by the Oregon-Idaho Conference of the United Methodist Church. It's a simple line.
If I might, Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, in some ways it may actually make it clearer because, or easier to check because it's on the marriage certificate
right.
Who you're holding yourself out to represent, and then you can go directly to that agent, that congregation or that organization and check there, as opposed to in the past it wasn't on the marriage certificate, right. So you'd have to go do a paper trail.
And it might be interesting to put this on the record. County clerks could, Adeline, I'm just imagining this, there'd be nothing that would stop them, you know, that says that they certify or that they're telling the truth in some way, that their authority to do marriage comes from such and such a source. And then they would have to claim that they got it off the internet, you know, or whatever, if that were the case.
Any further questions for Senator Shields?
Thank you for putting that on the record, yes. Senator.
I hope maybe county clerks will pick up on that.
Yes, thank you. Any further comments? We don't have a motion on this one on the floor. Someone would like to make a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 704 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cheryl Walker moves Senate Bill 704 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? 704A. Okay. Any objections? Could you call the roll, please?
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative Greenfelder?
Aye.
Representative Bingo?
Aye.
Representative Shirley?
Excused.
Representative Cheryl Walker?
Aye.
Representative Vicki Walker?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cleaver?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Lowe? Aye. Okay, Senate Bill 704A moves to the floor. We'll close the work session today. Who wants to be the carrier? Anyone want to volunteer?
Oh, why not? I asked the questions.
Dave Lowe?
Talk about the internet weddings.
Okay, we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 773A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 773 deals with the situation when a youth or a child is in under the custody of SCF or the Oregon Youth Authority, and there's an allegation or a claim that either of those state agencies has done something to that the child is going to sue for. Right now, there was kind of a no man's land as to who would submit the tort claim notice, because in actual fact, it should be that agency that's got custody of the child that would be responsible for doing it, and it just didn't make sense to have the agency that's going to be sued giving itself notice that it's going to be sued. So what this bill does is it exempts those specific claims from the tort claims notice requirement.
We have dashboards.
That's
part of the bill.
No, well. We called 773, so I did 773. So
okay.
723. Right, so there should be no amendments to this.
I had wrong.
And we had Senator Brown come and speak about this, and also Kathy Osborne from the Juvenile Rights Project, who spoke in favor of it, and no opposition to it.
Representative Ringo?
Just a comment. I mean, this seems like a really odd situation that arose from one special case, and this bill is intended to address that odd circumstance, though, where you've got a child, and the people that are looking out for the child are the ones that are essentially supposed to do the tort claim notice against themselves. It just doesn't make sense that they would do that. But on the other hand, that child ought not to be left without a remedy because of this kind of a catch-22 situation. So this is to resolve that. And it makes good sense, and there was no opposition to it.
Okay, any further comments? Chair would entertain a motion.
Chair, I move that the Senate bill, 773A, pass to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Ringo has moved Senate bill 773 to the floor with a due pass. Any questions, objections? Call the roll, please.
Representative Ackerman? Aye.
Representative
Ackerman? Aye.
Representative Ginsburg?
Aye.
Representative
Ringo? Aye.
Excused.
Representative Cheryl Walker?
Aye.
Representative Ricky Walker?
Aye.
Excused.
Vice Chair
Speaker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bell?
Aye.
Aye. Could you be the carrier? Okay. Representative Ringo will carry the bill. Move to the floor with the due pass. Close the work session.
Now
we're back to Senate Bill 713. We'll open a work session on that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 713A came from Senator Castillo, and the original bill deals with international adoptions and the registration the registration that's required in order for disclosure of confidential information and exempted international adoptions from being part of that procedure. And in addition to that, you have, and we didn't have anyone speak against it, in addition to that, you have dash A4 amendments, and those, I believe they take a House bill and add it on to this bill, but who? Okay. And I thought there was somebody here that wanted to speak to those. Bob, do you? Okay. And we also have the proponents of the bill here, too, the original bill. 713.
I think this is the first time we've seen the amendments, isn't it?
That's correct. Yeah. We just got these this morning.
I'd like somebody, Mr. Chair, to speak to the amendments, particularly since I haven't even heard.
Can you do that for us?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Bob Olson, Oregon State Bar. This was actually a law improvement bill from the family law section. They have an adoption subcommittee that was in the Senate, and just because of time, never got a priority to get a hearing in Senator Fisher's committee. And so we would still like it to be considered. I think the sponsor of this bill and other interested parties have all agreed it's a good bill. It provides availability of counseling with that will help birth parents in their decision-making process, and has no fiscal impact. The cost of counseling will be paid by the adoptive parents, and it will be required in both private agencies and independent adoptions, and it treats the parents equally. And I don't think there's any objections from SEF or anyone else. So,
any questions? Representative Cheryl Walker?
Mr. Chair, excuse me, Mr. Olson, down here on the front page of this proposed amendment, line 19, it says the counseling received within 1 year of the date of surrender. That seems like an awfully long time. I know adoptions typically aren't final for 1 year, but if a prospective mother gives up the child and on the 364th day decides she has regrets and wants to start counseling,
Doesn't that pose a problem? I would see that it would.
I think it may in a particular case. All I can tell you, Representative Walker, is that the our adoption committee and the Coalition of Oregon Adoption Agencies agreed that this would be the best provision, the best language, and that's what they decided on. So there may, we can certainly bring someone in to give you more information.
What I'm concerned about is that if within 1 year, if they come in on that last day and say, I want to start counseling, they have a right to 3 sessions. That would go over the year, which, as I understand adoptions, my sister has adopted several children. I have not, but that would cause perhaps a problem right at the end. Is there someone here that could answer that question?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Shetterly?
Well, I see it looks to me in lines 18 and 19 that the counseling would actually have to be received in 1 year, not so much not the request. The counseling was to actually be received. And I guess I want to make clear, I think your question suggested it, but that counseling referred to in sub 3 on lines 17 through 20 is still limited to the 3 sessions that appears in sub 1 above. I mean, we're not talking about a different or ongoing program of counseling under sub 3. That's still just the 3 sessions that are contemplated.
I believe that's true.
I'm just curious. Anybody know what those cost?
Mr. Chair, what I'm seeing, and I see that it's talking about they will pay for them if they occur within 1 year, but what if the person makes the request right at the end? The person may not be required to pay for them after the 1 year, but could they then contest the situation that now they want to stop the adoption, which to that point they could?
It looks like they'd have to make that decision early enough to get the counseling within the year. Is that
right, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Also, mm-hmm. Just on lines 22 through 24 on page 2, that it says, I guess, failure to provide notice is not grounds for setting aside an adoption. That doesn't address the failure to provide the counseling. I wonder if that's an issue that
I'd heard it discussed.
Madam Chair, I have a question.
Representative Vicki Walker.
Thank you. I have some personal experience in this issue, and it says here on line 14, before entry of a final decree of adoption, the agency or attorney providing the written notice shall submit verification to the court that the notice was given. So it doesn't, the adoption can take place once the notice is, once verification of the notice has been given. You don't have to wait until the birth mother gets counseling. That's not what this is saying from what I'm reading. So you can get your counseling whenever you want. I frankly think there should be a longer period than a year. I'm not going to quibble because sometimes these arrangements are worked out privately so that I think this is a minimum standard and that many arrangements can go beyond that. Is that correct, Mr.
I believe this is seen as the minimum that should be done, and more practitioners are doing this, even without the law.
Representative Lowe, do you have a question?
I do. I've done some adoptions, too. I love to do them. They're wonderful, feel-good kind of things that, a family practitioner gets little enough of, God knows. But I've done adoptions for families of modest means, too, who make excellent parents but don't have a whole lot of economic resources for the extras. And I believe that this is going to make adoption quite a bit more expensive for the prospective parents. And I'm just wondering if your committee discussed that or discussed what relief might be available to parents, adoptive parents of modest means.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, I know they did discuss the costs and have been concerned about that, but like I say, more and more lawyers are insisting that these services be provided in the course of adoption, so I think there's a growing consensus that this is an absolute essential thing to be done.
Mr. Chair.
Vicki Walker.
As a birth mother, Ms. Jackson, I would demand that this be done. This is a very traumatic thing for a woman to go through, and to deny her counseling because someone's of modest means is just not an acceptable argument for me. That's just the cost
of an adoption, and you need to figure it into your plan. I think probably the average cost of counseling would be somewhere, if I'm not mistaken, somewhere in the $80 to $100 range per session. And sometimes your insurance will even cover that.
Yeah. Yeah, Mr. Olson, Representative Walker, I'm not suggesting that it ought not to be done. I'm just asking, was there alternative funding discussed? I do think it should be done. I think it's important. But availability...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, I guess they were concerned about having any fiscal impact on this, and so that's why this was done as kind of a minimum standard in this fashion as a first step towards what probably needs to be done ultimately.
Yes, Representative Sherry. A couple of things. I guess my thinking is that given the emotional and financial and other commitments that adoptive parents are taking on with the adoption of a child, I don't see three sessions of counseling as being out of line with those. I would hope they ought to be able to factor those into the planning to adopt. But the one thing, I stumbled on an issue here in my last couple of comments that I think you might want to think about. You've got two things in this bill. One is a requirement of that notice be given. The other is that the counseling be provided. And then in sub 6 on page 2, we say that failure to give the notice is not grounds for setting aside an adoption. We don't say anything about failure to pay for the counseling. And I'm wondering, just to make sure that this doesn't, that doesn't create an inference that failure to provide the counseling might be grounds for setting aside consent, if maybe we would amend this, or would you think about clarifying it to indicate that a natural birth parent who would have a contract right or a right to recover a compelled payment by the adoptive parent to provide the counseling if they fail to do that, but that it otherwise wouldn't give constitute grounds to set aside the consent.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, all I can tell you is I know this language was pretty carefully negotiated. Certainly, if you wanted to prepare an amendment, I would make sure that we had somebody here from our adoption committee when it came back, and we could go from there. Or we could consider it later during the interim, but whatever you want to do.
You think Michael will say something?
Okay.
Representative Vicki Walker.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Shetterly's point is very well taken, because what if we do have a situation where they refuse to pay for the counseling and the birth mother does not get that counseling? Then there should be a basis for the adoption to be revoked if that's what she wants.
Okay. Representative Shetterly. My point, I think, would be otherwise, that that shouldn't be a basis to revoke it, but that we should make this clear. Now we're talking about the ambiguity that's in the statute, perhaps, by making it clear that failure to do one thing doesn't affect the validity of the adoption, but what about the failure to do the other that's unspoken? My preference would be that we say that that doesn't affect the validity of the consent, but that the birth mother have a legally enforceable right, birth parent have a legally enforceable right to compel payment, and we deal with it that way so that they make sure they get their consent. But that
compel payment rather than revoke adoption.
Yeah, think that's. I would rather see us go that way than to make that a basis to revoke an adoption. I think that's the more appropriate consequence.
Any further discussion on it? Mr. Olson, I think you need to maybe get together and make a couple changes, bring it back to us.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think we will pursue Representative Shetterly's idea and come back.
Any further comments on this bill? Are the proponents of the bill, original bill, here now? Would you come up, please? Please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Todd Quapish. I'm with Holt International Children's Services.
have you seen the amendments and read them and have an opinion on them?
This is the first time I've seen it, and Susan Cox, who is the Vice President of Public Policy External Affairs for our department and for Holt International, has not seen it. And so before I can even comment on this, I would have to bring this to her attention and work with her and the President and CEO of Holt International in regards to
this. Why don't you do that and keep in contact with Mr. Olson and see if you can work it out.
We'll do so.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 713. I think we're done for the day.
Good job.